Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they're sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1984 film Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, directed by Leonard Nimoy. It's weird. People don't like this movie, and I don't understand it.
Well, and I had some thoughts, because I like this movie. I think it's actually pretty good. The start of this movie is the end of the last movie. I mean, it picks up immediately where the other one left off.
Well, actually, it starts before the end, and they actually replay the end of the last movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, even before we get into it, do you think that was a good idea?
Well, I think it was necessary in some instances because there were people that didn't go see the second movie because the first movie was really bad, and so they didn't see the second. And again, I'm not saying the first movie was bad, but a lot of people didn't go see it, the second movie, because they thought the first movie was so bad. But then there was so much scuttlebutt after the second movie was good that they're like, well, some people came back for the third movie, especially because they kind of wanted to know what was going on after, you know, everybody's like, oh my God, they killed off Spock. So what are they going to do? So I think it was a way to give audiences who hadn't seen the second movie for whatever reason, it gave them kind of an alley-oop to get into the film with, you know, kind of a little bit of exposition up front without having to explain too much. Certainly it was a cheap vehicle to do that because, you know, they didn't have to really recreate much.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It was the cheapest way to do that. And I was thinking of another way to kind of do that in storytelling ways. I mean, Kirk has a really nice monologue, kind of a mental monologue that I'll drop in at some point. But really, you know, it was the most economical way to throw the exposition at you.
Yeah, and I took some exception to how they did it, though, because I did not like the black and white fade into color. I just thought it was kind of...
Well, how about the small screen fade into large screen?
Yeah, it was very like somebody learned how to use a new editing technique. It was just kind of kitschy.
Yeah. So
it seemed just kind of... It seemed rinky-dink. And you know, maybe that was the technology in 84. I don't know. But it was not aesthetically pleasing, and it wasn't a good style choice. If they had just had, you know, like a black and white full screen as a flashback, then that would have been cool. But this was, yeah, the small screen to big screen fade from black and white to color, but they did it in a really odd kind of way. To me, at least on my TV, the color fade in was really kind of ham-handed.
Yeah, I think so. I think you hit the nail on the head there. But, and then from there, it started like an episode. Just an episode of like The Next Generation, for instance.
It was pretty good pace, though. I mean, it went on at a good clip.
Oh, I really like this movie a lot because it brought me back to the TV show that I remembered. It played to everybody's strengths, except for that sort of a clunky opening. And then one phrase that I'll talk about later, nothing took me out of it. I was really happy to go along for the ride.
Yeah.
I mean, even the cheese, it's funny. I was thinking, trying to think of a bad analogy, and the best I can come up with is this movie has lots of cheese in it, but it's a cheeseburger. This is not like going to a famous steakhouse. This is going to get a decent quality cheeseburger. And a key feature of the cheeseburger is cheese.
I wrote because I'm a little OCD, which surprises no one. I have a notebook together of all of my notes for podcasting. So this is, you know, I've got it like Star Trek II and Star Trek I are all in the same notebook right here as I turn the page. And so I write down, you know, I write down the title, and then I usually have a little quippy one-liner just for myself to amuse myself. But I wrote down this one, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, and then in parentheses I put, and Shatner's acting.
Well, I mean, we were talking about how there was some ham-handedness in the beginning, and there's some cheese throughout, but there's also some hamming it up. So this is like a ham and cheese sandwich.
Yeah, but overall in this film, I think Shatner does a better acting job.
Oh, and they give him the right things to act. That's the thing.
Yeah, and so I think this script was better suited to him, to his style. But a lot of that turns out to be Lenny, as the crew apparently calls him.
Oh, yeah, no, Nimoy really did a great job with this film and with getting the actors to do what he envisioned. And not all of them did so willingly at first. Like, I think everybody was whinging a little bit.
Well, and so I was watching all the extra, there's an entire interview that I have on the DVD with Shatner and Nimoy about the making of the film and how Leonard Lenny became, you know, he said that he was, you know, gonna, how it came to be that he was
the director?
The director. He was the producer, director.
Well, the major producer, Harv Bennett, was the writer that was suggesting that, oh, great, now they've hired a director that they can't fire.
That's true. Well, and apparently, I don't know if you want to talk about it now or talk about it later.
No, let's talk about it now. That's fine.
I got to go back to my notes because I took a lot of notes on the extra stuff.
And we'll get into the plot here, you know, eventually. But if you're listening this far, hopefully you've listened to the other two shows. You know, we're talking about the experience of being a viewer and the experience of them trying to make it just as much as the experience of, you know, the storytelling. Because the storytelling is actually pretty simple.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty formulaic.
Yeah, and it's okay because this is a Western, remember? So I don't have to tell you to remember, but it is a Western, and it is an adventure story with some, you know, morality tales thrown in.
Yeah. So 3 days after the opening of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Michael Eisner, then the president of Paramount, gave the green light for Star Trek III. And because of Star Trek, the motion picture, and them getting Leonard Nimoy to come back for The Wrath of Khan, you know, he had written in that he wanted killed off, but not because he wanted out of the show. He just thought it would be good drama. And I don't think Leonard Nimoy expected anything after the second movie. And so when they came to him for the third movie, he said he never expected that he would get to direct, but he knew they couldn't make the movie really without him, even though they'd killed him. But he was kind of like, I'm not coming to this movie unless I can direct it. And he kind of dug his heels in, and apparently it went round and round and round and round. And Michael Eisner ended up with Leonard Nimoy actually calling Michael Eisner and saying, what's the hold up? You know? And Michael Eisner said, well, you know, I was told that the reason that we couldn't, you know, we can't do this is because you had a clause in the second, you know, in the second movie that you were to be killed off and that you wouldn't come back. And that was written in your contract. And so we can't bring you back because that was in your contract. And Leonard Nimoy said, that was never written in my contract. You have my contract in your office. Go to your production office where my contract is sitting in a file cabinet and look at it. It nowhere says that. And so then Michael Eisner said, oh, I'll take your word for it. And then they negotiated it in. But he had never directed before. So he turned to Shatner and said, hey, you know, what do you think? And so Shatner said, I'm doing this cop drama show. So why don't you come and direct, come and watch and direct an episode of that. And then I'll teach you everything I know. And then you can go back and direct the film. So Shatner takes a lot of credit, and Leonard Nimoy actually gave Shatner a lot of credit too for allowing him to direct an entire episode of T.J. Hooker while Shatner was coaching him.
Yeah, so, which is actually pretty impressive. I mean, for some guy who's supposed to be like a megalomaniac, this being Shatner, that's a pretty generous thing.
Yeah. Well, and considering, you know, Shatner, it was Shatner, you know, T.J. Hooker was apparently Shatner's show. I mean, it was, you know, it was really all him, which is no surprise. But, you know, Leonard Nimoy speaks very highly of William Shatner and even goes on to say, you know, he attributes the success of Star Trek based on the chemistry of all of the actors. And he said that Shatner's energy and theatrical ability are really kind of one of the things that made them a cohesive unit, which is a kind of a dumbfounding statement, I thought. I thought, you know, he's not known for his theatrical ability, is he? I mean, is his dramatic overacting theatrical? Is, you know, is William Shatner, you know, is this a joke on all of us that he was overplaying it to overplay it to fuck with us?
Like as a technique?
So, yeah. And then apparently also there was a fire in the middle of the production in the Paramount stage that destroyed at one point like a half of the set, which almost doomed the production at that point. And Shatner makes himself out to be the hero. And listening to him talk about, you know, him holding the fire hose and directing the firemen and all of this was just like ridiculous.
Oh my God.
It was so cheesy. I was like, wow. But, the final thing that I'll point out from the extra stuff that I got, was that when they wrote this, first of all, there are five actors that played Spock in this movie.
I know. And actually, Leonard Nimoy doesn't get credit until the very end.
Yeah. Well, he's not in it. I mean, ostensibly, he's not in it for 2/3 of the movie.
Well, it's true, but he's in it throughout, at least either in video or his voice.
He has almost no acting and almost no lines.
But we'll get there. When he does act at the end, it's really impressive.
It is. It is. But and his paycheck must have been huge for the work he didn't do. But, again, he was directing, so, you know, he was busy. So it kind of explains why he was not, you know, not in front of the camera as much. But the one point that they made, and I don't know which one of the I didn't write down who to attribute this to, so I'll just say I don't know who of the entourage who I was watching on the DVD, but the Klingon versus the Federation is very much Russia versus the U.S., which is very much the atomic bomb versus Genesis.
That makes sense. I mean, that's in the show, it had always been that way, that the Klingons were the Soviets. Although this movie really defined the new version of the Klingons as a race. Before, they were just sort of the bad guys, and there was no really nuance to them. But now you get the warrior race, the whole mindset of the Klingons really is developed in this movie. I mean, they took it from there directly to Worf.
Yeah, they really kind of expounded upon what it was to be the Klingon universe. But, you know, I didn't get growing up. I didn't understand that the Klingons were the Russians. That never occurred to me. And you and I have discussed before that, you know, I think we all had a very kind of different growing up in the Cold War, as it were, in Alaska. It was kind of its own little bubble anyway. But I never connected those dots.
Yeah. And I think it just probably came more instinctual to me, although it was impressive at the time that they actually made Chekhov part of the crew so that it wasn't explicitly the Russians. It was just sort of implied that it was a U.S. versus Russian kind of thing they had.
Yeah.
With like the neutral zone and everybody's kind of, you know, it's a Cold War going on.
And again, none of that, I mean, that just, it never occurred to me. I mean, I never connected those dots, and I might have been you know, I was 10, 12 years old. So I don't know that I would have had that kind of advanced political structure in my head. So.
Well, and you know, really, it's just, again, it's like it's a Western. It's good guys, bad guys. You don't really think too much about the plight of the Indians. You just know that they're the adversaries.
Yeah. And again, you know, history is invariably written by the victor. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and, you know, I mean, they can, if they want to right now, they could go ahead, especially with Worf being part, you know, the Klingons now being, what, part of the Federation or united with the Federation. You know, now you could have the whole Klingon Trail of Tears story be told.
Yeah.
Although, again, yeah. I don't know. So anyway, shall we just dive into the plot then?
Yeah. And so in the opening of this, though, I will say there's a couple errors, or at least I thought they were errors, and I didn't have time to go back and look, but I may watch again this weekend and see. There's the very, very opening, I think, where they're showing the ship. There doesn't seem to be any damage on the front end of the ship. And then later on, you see there's damage all over the ship. And so I think they had a little bit of a continuity error because they used an old model.
Well, an old model. It's possible they used just the old footage, too.
Well, that's true, too. So, and I'm sorry, to tangent back to the point earlier that you said you don't know why people didn't like this movie. My theory as to why some people didn't like this movie is a little bit of the death fatigue. Because, you know, you see Star Trek II and you go through Spock dying, and you see that deeply, deeply affect, you know, Kirk. And, you know, you can see that, you know, it's kind of, it has a bit of a devastating effect to him, but he carries on. And then this movie comes along and Kirk's rolling on along and he's reunited with his son, you know, and he's actually able to admit and be allowed to engage his son as his son. And he gets that closeness in dealing with his grief. And then as it turns out, his son is then killed, and then he has more grief. So I think there may have been some grief fatigue going on, and some people kind of were off put by the fact that it's like, okay, is somebody going to die in every movie? I mean, granted, the red shirts always die, but, you know, is there going to be this, like, are we going to have to watch William Shatner cry every damn movie?
Well, and usually the red shirts aren't really wearing white shirts with a yachting sweater over their shoulder.
Yeah, so, and they don't have the crazy, like, ultra blonde perm. So,
but it really, he really got a haircut for this role. It actually looks much better.
Yeah, well, also, I think he actually went through puberty. So,
well, I mean, yeah, everybody aged. It's funny. This is actually, even though it didn't, you know, the film starts, you know, exactly where the last one took off. This definitely people aged.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's I think maybe because we didn't understand that this is the middle of a trilogy. You know, the first one was kind of a one-off, but Wrath of Khan, The Search for Spock, and The Voyage Home are all there's a whole overarching trilogy. So, you know, this is The Empire Strikes Back. This is going to be probably a little more edgy or a little more maybe depressing. And then hopefully the third one will bring up the spirits and everybody will clap at the end of the show.
Yeah. But this wasn't as good as Star Trek II. It wasn't. It was, you know, but it was, I give it a solid B+.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think it actually had elements that were better than Star Trek II. Not overall, but the crew got a better, everybody in the crew got a time, at least a minute, to do something fun.
Yeah, everybody was involved and engaged.
Yeah. And in the first, you know, in Wrath of Khan, you had basically just the top four. You had right. Spock and Kirk and Bones and Scotty. But, you know, and then you had some Chekhov. And in this movie, you know, Sulu and Uhura get more action, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, so the starship Enterprise is limping back to Earth. By the way, as always, plots are cobbled together from bits and pieces, Wikipedia and IMDb all strewn together. So, the Starship Enterprise limps back to Earth following the battle with Khan, and during the whole battle, of course, there was Spock that died, and the Genesis device was deployed into the nebula cloud and making the Genesis planet. And then during the funeral, they jettison Spock's body in a photon torpedo tube where it eventually lands on Genesis. And we get to see that whole tearjerker thing again. And then Kirk has that monologue that I talked about earlier.
USS Enterprise Captain's personal log. With most of our battle damage repaired, we're almost home. Yet I feel uneasy, and I wonder why. Perhaps it is the emptiness of this vessel. Most of our trainee crew have been reassigned. Lieutenant Savick and my son David are exploring the Genesis planet, which he helped create. And Enterprise feels like a house with all the children gone. No, more empty even than that. The death of Spock is like an open wound. It seems that I have left the noblest part of myself back there on that newborn planet.
So it starts off kind of on a downer note for the Enterprise crew. You know, even though, like, the young guy's like, hey, are we going to get a parade when we get home? And Kirk's like, yeah, you know, yeah, guess we deserve one this time. Then we cut to a space smuggling vehicle who's trying to sell the Genesis data to a Klingon commander named Krug, played by Christopher Lloyd.
A very young Christopher Lloyd.
Well, what did you think about Christopher Lloyd?
I thought he was great.
I thought he was great, too. I mean, this is before Back to the Future, but after Reverend Jim.
Yeah, and he said he was really nervous about this because it wasn't really a comedic role. And he was, you know, it gave him a real good chance to act, and he felt good about that. But having no knowledge of the show, the actress that played Savick actually said, you know, he had some problems when they were directing him because when, you know, there are times like when Krug is on the planet with his communicator saying, beam me up, he doesn't get how the communicator works. So he's like holding his arms out and flapping at the sky.
Oh, that's kind of funny.
Because, you know, he doesn't really get how the communicator worked because he wasn't really part of the show. And so she said, you know, there were some funny parts like that where we had to kind of coach him. So anyway, but it gave him a, he says he had a great time and he really, you know, he really thought about how he needed to act it. And Leonard Nimoy gave him some really good credit for that.
Well, he did a great job, I thought.
And I absolutely agree. I think he did a great job.
A question about the Klingon ship. Is the Klingon ship really a Romulan bird of prey? I think
they had some different shapes to them.
Well, I think
they're pretty similar.
Well, but I think they actually had the bad guys were supposed to be the Romulans in this movie. And they changed it to Klingons for reasons I don't remember in the trivia. But I think the actual, like, the bird on the bottom, I think that's actually like a Romulan ship design. And I realize this is really, like, you know, hitting like nerd central. But the ship looks great. It is a great looking ship.
Yeah, I think the Romulan, I mean, the Klingon ship's pretty distinct in their, especially in their weapon array. So I don't know. I think, both the Klingons and the Romulans both kind of had similar designs anyway.
But wasn't it called the Romulan bird of prey, or was it a Klingon bird of prey, the ship?
It's a Klingon bird of prey.
Is it really? Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, then never mind.
The Romulans were largely unknown because they're pretty reclusive.
I swear I thought the bird of prey was the Romulan ship design. I could be wrong, though. I don't know.
Well, I have a machine that will tell us, so.
Yeah, let's look.
Romulan bird of prey. Let's see. 23rd century. So the Romulan bird of prey looks kind of like a flat Enterprise. So the Romulan bird of prey there's a type of space vessel that was in blah, blah, blah. Okay, so there is a Romulan bird of prey, so there's that. But now let's look at Klingon bird of prey. These are all from memory alpha, by the way. So the Klingon bird of prey is spindly and has like feet. And
there is something called the Klingon bird of prey.
Yeah, and that's what we saw in the movie.
That's craziness.
Oh, well. The Klingon bird. Well, but they both. I mean, I don't know, birds. I don't know, and I don't know why the Klingons would call them birds anyway, because who knows what Klingon birds look like? But it's a warship, according to the Memory Alpha wiki. So the bird of prey is kind of a pod spaceship with spindly legs on the sides, which I would suppose are the engines, without going into deep. But the Romulan bird of prey looks very much like if the Enterprise just had a saucer and the engines on the sides.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, and the Enterprise isn't a pure battleship, right?
No, it's not a battleship. It's just a space vessel.
Yeah.
It's an exploration vessel.
There's a term for it they have in here, like a heavy cruiser or something. Anyway, again, this is minutiae.
Good God, this is like a black hole. You could get locked in this stuff for eons.
Oh yeah, no, it's I can't forget the character's name, of course, but Justin Long's character in Galaxy Quest. Oh God.
We need to rope it back in. But, yeah.
Because all I put in my notes that what started this whole thing was great Klingon ship. Also, hopefully this will not turn into a 20-minute discussion, but how about a great Klingon dog?
Yeah, it was pretty good for 84.
I thought it was great. It was practical effects. It was freaking... There was a couple of instances of puppetry in this movie that was great.
Yeah. Yeah, it was gory, and it was gruesome, and it was mean, but it was also kind of cute.
It was adorable, and it was just enough of a wink at the audience.
Yeah.
You know, the Klingons are crazy warlike, but they're not all that different. They got dogs. Look at them.
Yeah. Do you think it looked a little Henson-esque?
Oh, totally. It had to be Henson. Or people that had worked in the Henson factory, because there's no way it couldn't have been.
Yeah, I think so, probably too.
Yeah, because who else was doing it like that back then? I mean, maybe there were other companies.
Not many. They were all probably ripping him off.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. At least that's the story I'm going to believe. So we've got Christopher Lloyd, Commander Krug, getting the Genesis data, and then paying the smuggler by destroying the smuggler's ship, which, by the way, includes Krug's girlfriend or whatever. She dies honorably, though, because that's what Klingons do.
Yeah.
But then we flash to the Enterprise back at Earth, arriving at Space Dock. And we get a little bit of ship porn, but it's really abbreviated. I think it was really tastefully done. It was kind of like softcore ship porn, where we get a look at the Excelsior and its transwarp drive, or we hear talk about the transwarp drive. And Dr. McCoy begins acting strangely. He breaks into Spock's quarters, and when Kirk confronts him, he speaks in Spock's voice and starts talking in gibberish about going home and climbing up the steps of Mount Blobbly Blue.
Really?
Well, and actually, I really credit DeForest Kelly with doing some good Nimoy impressions.
Yeah, I really did. I also wonder how much they voiced over.
Well, no. I don't mean the vocal impression, because, yeah, I'm sure it was really Nimoy's voice.
Facial expressions and the tics.
Yeah, just like the arching of the eyebrow. And
yeah, he did a really good job.
Yeah, I thought he did great. So then we meet Starfleet Admiral Morrow, played by Robert Hooks. I just thought he was the Old Spice macho guy in the recent commercials. Because he's awesome. A smooth operator.
Yeah.
And he's got that Starfleet mustache rocking.
He's wearing some high karate, and he's got a bottle of Colt 45.
I was going to say, yes, he's like the Billy Dee Williams. So he arrives on the Enterprise and informs the crew that the ship is going to be decommissioned, and they're ordered not to speak about Genesis ever, because it's very controversial.
It's confidential.
Well, both confidential and controversial.
Even though it's so confidential, everybody seems to know about it.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So
it's like the worst secret ever.
Well, we cut to the Genesis planet, and we see David Marcus, Merritt Buttrick, Kirk's son, and a key scientist in the Genesis development. And we see Lieutenant Savick, who has been replaced, Kirstie Alley has been replaced, by her choice, by the way, by Robin Curtis. And they're investigating the Genesis planet aboard the science vessel Grissom. Named not for the CSI guy, but instead for Virgil.
I knew you were going to go there.
Well, he was named for Virgil Gus Grissom from Apollo 1, who died in the horrible Apollo 1 accident. He had the right stuff. But I want to know, I mean, there's tiny things that I'm going to bitch about in this movie. But again, I like the movie a lot. But
I wrote down a couple of things I think you're going to complain about. So go ahead.
Yeah. Where's Carol Marcus?
I actually wrote that down. Actually, I wrote that down towards the end of the movie. I think end of the movie and nowhere to be found is Carol Marcus.
No, they don't even mention her. No. I mean, all they had to do is drop a little note when Kirk says that half the crew's been, you know, shipped off or replaced or whatever. And we dropped off Carol back at her home planet of Zibbidi-Zab.
Yeah, I think maybe, I don't know, maybe she's asking for too much money. I don't know.
I don't know. Actually, I guess it wouldn't be her home. Well, it could be her home planet, not her birth planet. I don't know. But yeah, also, the question is, you know, Robin Curtis does a fine job, but did it have to be Savick? Like,
yeah, I don't know.
Like, I guess they wanted the continuity, but why not just change the name?
Well, and I wonder if they were really trying to get Kirstie Alley, and they wrote it for her, they wrote the part for her, and then she backed out. I don't know.
Well, she said she didn't do it because she didn't want to be typecast.
Stupid. But,
well,
all right.
No, I mean, you know, if you think about it, there were, I mean, like, what, Nichelle Nichols wasn't really playing a lot of other characters, so.
Well, yeah.
But, probably presumptuous. And she still had Look Who's Talking and Look Who's Talking 2 in her future, right?
Oh, God, yes.
Well, that's for later in the podcast catalog.
Well, actually, in the making of, is it Look Who's Talking? Have you seen either of them, by the way?
I think I've seen both of them. I mean, not recently.
Kirstie Alley makes a Star Trek reference because she's like, she had like a Halloween costume and they said, what are you? And she said, well, I'm a Vulcan or something. She made some reference. She has some throwaway line that was like, oh, yeah.
Oh, well, that's fun. See? Yeah, Kirstie Alley did a fine job in the last movie. And again, Robin Curtis does a fine job in this movie. But it's just not quite the same. So it's not any big deal, really, but still.
Yeah, I have no complaints.
So
I can't think of anybody else who would have been better had it not been Kirstie Alley.
Yeah. I mean, it's fine. The only other note I have on the Grissom is poor Captain Esteban's pink chair. So
I was waiting for the moment, however, because I wrote, how long is it going to take Eric to draw the comparison to 2001? Did you have the comparison moment?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Not at all. So, you tell me the comparison.
So when they're scanning on the planet and they find the life form and they says, hey, it's 2 meters by 3 meters.
Is that the same dimension as the...
The monolith is 1 by 2 by 3. That's the dimension of the model. And so it made me laugh because it looked monolithic on their little two-dimensional scanner. And they're like, 2 meters by 3 meters. And I thought, well, isn't that a bitch? Like, you can't get away from the monolith anywhere.
That's some craziness.
And then I wrote down Griffin did not like the Klingon dogs at all.
Oh, I bet. Then we cut back to Earth, and the Enterprise commanding officers are having a drink in Kirk's condo. And they're wearing ridiculous uniforms, including some people have suggested that Kirk was maybe wearing his, like, running outfit, because it looks kind of like a tracksuit.
Oh, well.
Anyway, it was fine. I mean, it's better than the costumes in the first Star Trek movie, so.
Oh, my God, yes.
So then Sarek shows up. And is pretty pissed at Kirk that he didn't bring Spock's body back to Vulcan.
Yeah, he was WTF, dude.
No, he was like, I might also, but only his body was in death, you idiot.
Yeah.
Like, he asked you to bring his body and his Katra to Vulcan. And then Kirk's like, well, he made no request. He wouldn't have spoken it openly.
Duh.
Yeah, it's like the fucking, it's Kirk's funeral, Kobayashi Maru. He can't win.
Yeah, but didn't I say that at the end of the second movie? I'm like, I sure hope the death ritual was that they just shove his ass in a photon torpedo and shoot him out somewhere.
Well, exactly, yeah. But all it takes is a mind meld and very good quality security footage to tell us what we already know, that McCoy is the keeper of the Katra. And Spock's Katra is his spirit. And
his living spirit.
His living spirit and his body are needed for them to lay at rest on this homeworld of Vulcan. And now that we know McCoy is the keeper of the Katra, McCoy will die from carrying the Katra if it's not deposited with Spock's body on Vulcan. Which poses a problem. We need to get Spock's body back. In the meantime, Krug takes his cloaked ship to the Genesis planet and blows up the Grissom. And then goes down and captures Marcus, Savick, and Spock. And by the way, I failed to mention that Marcus and Savick go down to the Genesis planet surface and find out we got some problems here. The Genesis planet is unstable because David Marcus had used, what did he call him?
Protomatter.
Yeah, which is, as Savick points out, is no one uses protomatter.
Yeah, Savick is a big buzzkill about it, too.
Oh,
what a bitchy buzzkill. You cheated like your father.
Yeah. And David's like, well, I had to cut some corners. It wasn't really, like, if we had to get it, you know, come on, man, give me a break.
Yeah, and also, I want to say, those are the biggest fucking microbes I've ever seen.
Well, they are definitely evolving at a great rate.
Yeah, but microbes don't get... They wouldn't be microbes if they were that big. Microbes.
Yeah, no, I got it. Yeah, they would be macrobes.
Like, or something.
Yeah. So yeah. Well, they eventually evolve into big snake things.
Yeah, but later, because they're still like weird little spiny, gross-looking snail things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when Savick and David see them. And then they see...
Yeah. And at this point, they haven't... Yeah, I was going to say, at this point, they haven't really seen anything, but they open the photon torpedo lid. David kind of dramatically opens it, and you see nothing but Spock's burial robe.
Yes, folded neatly.
But no body.
No. No, ain't nobody.
Okay, so, and I'm going to pick this apart a little. So, you've just been reanimated... Except you've been reanimated dead, and in what form? Because somehow it reanimated him into a fetus, which is a little, not sure how that works, but it reformed his matrix or whatever. But then it conveniently folded his tunic and put it in the case.
Well, there's that. And there's also the fact that he is growing much faster than he normally would. And he's growing in spurts. Like the planet.
But you don't even know that because at this point we haven't even seen him.
That's true.
Like we don't know anything about, but again, like, so he's some nasty radiated thing that they put him in a photon torpedo tube and he's reanimated in some fashion into a fetus form. But again, the robe magically folds itself. It's a magic space robe. Like Billy Mays created it. It's an auto folding robe. Future fabrics. I don't know.
You know, it's also very clean too.
That was the other thing. Like for a dead guy, it was like it lacked any kind of grossness. And I guess that was probably cinematically they didn't want to make grossness, but still.
Am I allowed to say ancient Chinese secret? Probably not.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. But, you know, those commercials are still on YouTube, by the way.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of stuff that's on YouTube that you cannot get away with doing today in commercials.
Yeah, I agree.
So, so then we find out Spock is actually down there. He's a boy, and he's cold, because that's the other thing about Genesis, is that they have all these crazy climate zones that are all right next to each other, so you've got snow on the cactus and that kind of thing.
But they haven't got there yet.
Okay, sorry.
Just saying.
Okay, well. I'll let you guide me when we're at the right place, because evidently my notes aren't the greatest.
Well, that's okay. I mean, the only point I'm going to make is when they finally do discover him, he's Jen the Gelfling from the Dark Crystal.
Oh, he totally is. Absolutely is. Yes.
And if any of you don't know who that is, go look it up.
I think Drew and I are going to do the Dark Crystal at some point.
You should actually see if you can get a screen grab of Jen and the teenage Spock and put it together.
Oh yeah, we could. I want to get a screen grab of Admiral Morrow and the Old Spice guy. Back to Krug. Krug takes his cloak ship. The cloaking device is the most important part of the ship, and sneaks up on the Grissom and destroys it. And so Marcus and Savick, and then the young Spock are down on the planet surface. And back at Earth, Kirk, having talked to Sarek, has a little meet with Admiral Morrow and directly asks for permission to take the Enterprise back to the Genesis planet. And Morrow says, nope. He also says, very curiously, that Kirk's career has been one of rationality, not intellectual chaos. Like, has he not watched the series?
I was going to say, that's a little bit of revisionist history, I think.
I think so, yes. Has he not realized how often Kirk breaks the Prime Directive?
Yeah, and repeated, and how many times he's been demoted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's demoted and promoted and demoted and promoted more than anyone else there.
Yeah.
The only reason he's not still an admiral is he can't grow that mustache. So, of course, Kirk immediately, you know, plays nice. Because he immediately, you know, meets up with the rest of the gang, and then they're like, oh, so what's the word? He goes, the word is no, so we're going to do it anyway. And they're going to go fetch Dr. McCoy. And where is Dr. McCoy?
In the booby hatch.
He is at the bar, basically trying to hire...
Oh, I forgot, you're right.
Yeah, no, sorry, yeah, he hasn't got to the booby hatch yet. No, he is at a bar trying to hire, basically, Han Solo to take him to Genesis. But Han Solo we meet Han Solo... he's very slurpy, and he also speaks like Yoda, except with Yoda as portrayed by Wallace Shawn from The Princess Bride.
To your planet, welcome.
I think that's my line, stranger.
Oh, forgive. I here am new. But you are known being McCoy from Enterprise.
You have me at a disadvantage, sir.
By name not important. You seek I. Message received. Available ship stands by.
How much and how soon?
How soon is now. How much is... Where?
Somewhere in the Mutara sector.
Oh, Mutara restricted. Take permits, many. Money, more.
There aren't going to be any damn permits. How can you get a permit to do a damn illegal thing? Look, price you name, money I got.
Place you name, money I name, otherwise bargain, no.
All right, damn it. It's Genesis. The name of the place we're going is Genesis.
Genesis?
Yes, Genesis. How can you be deaf with ears like that?
Genesis allowed is not. Is planet forbidden?
Look, backwards, friend. Genesis may be planet forbidden, but I'm damn welcome.
Sir, I'm sorry, but your voice is carrying. I don't think you want to be discussing this subject in public.
I'll discuss what I like. And who in the hell are you?
Could I offer you a ride home, Dr. McCoy?
Where's the logic in offering me a ride home, you idiot? If I wanted a ride home, would I be trying to charter a space flight? How in the hell do you know who I am?
Federation security, sir. You're gonna get a nice long rest, Doctor.
I really didn't like this character.
Oh, I loved it, except it was so bad. I mean, it was just cheese. It wasn't badly done. It was just cheesy and unnecessary. It was the Jar Jar Binks of this particular movie.
Oh my God!
What?
I just realized Maltz.
Yeah, Maltz is John Larroquette.
Oh my God!
Oh, there's no way you would even know. There's no way.
I know the voice because I'm a huge Night Court fan.
Oh,
I
yeah?
loved Night Court. And he had a couple cameos in West Wing, which are pretty fantastic too.
He was also the opening voice of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Fantastic.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, well, it's not your kind of movie, let's just say. I think you would find it very unpleasant.
To no shock.
But yeah, no. Also, Miguel Ferreira is in this movie.
Who is he?
He is some kind of...
Oh, he's the first officer.
Yeah. He's in everything.
Yeah, he is.
Anyway, so back to the bar. McCoy is getting more and more heated, his discussion. At first, it's sort of in code with Han Solo, but it ends up being pretty loud. So we have another Old Spice guy. I'll call him Young Spice. Slides up in the booth with McCoy. Another attractive black man with a big old mustache. And said, you're getting kind of loud. You need to calm it down. And McCoy tries to do the Vulcan neck pinch thing on him.
I wrote that down because I'm like, McCoy trying to do the Spock pinch to the security agent in the bar is one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Oh, it's great. And the guy's like, what you trying to do? I can defeat you with my mustache. So McCoy gets arrested. And when Kirk goes to visit him in lockup, he's in detention, as they say, en route to the Federation Funny Farm.
Yeah.
And what does Kirk say?
Make it quick, Admiral. They are moving him to the Federation Funny Farm.
Yes, poor friend. I hear he's fruity as a nutcake.
2 minutes.
Why would Kirk say fruity as a nutcake?
I don't know.
It's just weird. It's a weird choice.
I'm guessing it's an ad lib that they let go.
It must have been. It must have been.
They were all too afraid to correct the great Shat.
Yeah, it's like, fine, whatever. It's not harming anybody.
They're just going to leave the Shat.
Yes. So Kirk goes to visit McCoy, and he says, how many fingers am I holding up? And I thought, well, that was pretty cute. And then and then Sulu comes in and has to urgently talk to Kirk. And that's when they make their great escape from McCoy. And it's funny because apparently George Takei didn't like the fact that the security guy called him tiny. And
yeah.
And Nimoy's like, that's the way this whole thing works. That's why it's funny when you do your little thing on him. And he had to admit that, oh yeah, it wouldn't have worked anyway, any other way. So Sulu got to be called tiny and then do his little judo flip or whatever.
I really love that because it gave, George Takei, like, it gave some depth to his character, finally, that had been lacking.
Exactly. Yeah, he got a chance to shine. Same thing with Uhura coming up. She got a chance to shine. Fantastic. She locks the guy in the closet.
Except I have to say, and I will say, I'm a big Mo, so I get to say this, but, like, George Takei's acting is pretty gay.
Well,
it didn't matter the flip and the... It's like, okay.
Okay, the fact that he's wearing a big leather cape.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
I mean,
like he might as well had a scarf and like said swinger or something.
Well, the only guy who's wearing gayer clothes is Chekhov, because Chekhov has that weird pink suit on.
Yeah, well, it was Russian. Maybe he was being edgy.
I guess.
Maybe he was, for the Anna Karenina, or who knows.
And Kirk's got his jogging suit on, so that maybe they're both, they're all around the athletic club / bathhouse.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they're all going to play a racquetball or something.
Yeah, I'm sure Kirk's Condo Association has a racquetball court. I can see that.
Yeah, or a squash court.
Yeah, no, racquetball. Absolutely racquetball.
Never racquetball.
Never anything else but racquetball.
That's what I'm saying.
That is so perfect.
That was the selling point to our apartments is they had racquetball courts.
Oh, yeah? No, I remember.
They tried to sell us that shill. And then, we went to look at them and they were like full of like tumbling mats and chattel.
Yeah. Yeah, now that's The Office, by the way.
The Office is where the racquetball center used to be?
I think so, yeah.
What they do with The Office?
Turn
it into another apartment?
Yeah, I'm sure. Or maybe maybe it's part of the new computer lounge or something. I don't know.
I don't really even care. But,
yeah. Now that it's a gated facility, I don't get to go drive around there much anymore.
Is it gated now, really?
Oh, yeah.
Who's that going to keep out? All it's going to do is keep the people in.
Well, it solves probably some of the vandalism of the cars at night. But
maybe, except most of the vandalism is probably from the other buildings.
Could anyway, have been. Yeah.
Never mind. Just moving on.
No, it's okay. Yeah. Anyway. So back on Genesis, we catch up with Savick and the young Spock, and she explains to David that Spock has to go through Ponfar, which he has to do once every 7 years. That's when Spock gets in heat.
Yeah.
And so faster than you can say, "Coo-coo-coo-choo," Mrs. Savick, she starts to finger him.
This actually made me uncomfortable because it's the adolescent Spock and the dirty fingering sex with Savick.
Oh, it's Mary Savick Letourneau.
It's really kind of like, I was like, ew.
Yeah. It's not great. And presumably, even though it keeps cutting away, presumably because he ages throughout this whole thing, she's got to do this a couple times.
Yeah, because it's every 7 years, I think.
Yeah, and he's rapidly aging, so, I mean, I'm pretty sure by the end she's got a headache or finger or cramp or whatever.
Well, maybe she's enjoys multiple. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. Who knows?
Maybe she's very tantric. And, you know. Yeah.
That's why their eyebrows are all big and tall.
That's why they got pointy ears.
Yeah. So at this point, by the way, I failed to mention, as Kirk is breaking McCoy out, Scotty is saying goodbye to the Excelsior because he has been transferred to the Excelsior because he's the top engineer. He doesn't like that idea. In fact, he says goodnight to the captain and gets into the elevator of the Excelsior to leave.
Level, please.
Transporter room.
Thank you.
Up your shaft.
He has a lot of contempt for the new ship.
He does. He doesn't believe the transwarp drive is all that big a deal.
But he thinks the ship is too much technology and not enough mechanics.
Yeah. So he steals the spark plugs out of the transwarp drive.
And, something like that.
Yeah, and then they go on to, and Uhura locks the dude in the closet and transports them aboard the Enterprise, except she's going to meet them at the rendezvous location later. She actually hopefully got a big paycheck for not being in much of this movie. So they get onto the Enterprise, and now they can run the Enterprise with just like five guys or four guys. I think it's five guys.
Yeah, Scotty has, quote, rigged it for automation.
Yes, and don't let the Federation find out about that, because otherwise there'll be massive layoffs. Yeah. So they break out of space dock. And how do you get out of space dock? You got to open the space doors.
Yeah, but now you get another gratuitous space-suited dude as the ship is pulling out, except this time he doesn't have his helmet on.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't even notice him.
Yeah, he's in the bar, like, waving on the Enterprise as they're leaving through one of the portals. He's looking at it. And I'm like, I wrote it down. Oh, another space-suited dude. Oh, this time he doesn't have a helmet. You can see his head.
Oh, that's funny. At least he doesn't have to get hurtled off and smash his legs against a pole or something. Yeah, so the Enterprise escapes Earth because the Excelsior engine just dies. And that captain, sitting with his pretentious writing crop in his lab, is, stuck with his crop and nothing else. So the Enterprise then goes to Genesis. And they're in orbiter on Genesis, and all of a sudden they get attacked by Krug. And there's this little standoff that follows, and Krug is like, look, we've got three hostages. By the way, it's funny because, you know, Krug was really pissed when they destroyed the Grissom. They destroyed the Grissom on accident. He says he wanted hostages.
Right.
Although it's funny because didn't Kirk tell Savick in the last movie that Klingons don't take hostages.
Yeah.
So that's just crazy.
Well, except that I think Krug's point was he wanted it as negotiating. It was a negotiating currency.
Yeah.
That was the implication that he wanted prisoners. Did he say prisoners or did he say, anyway, whatever term he used, I think the implication was that he was going to use that as kind of bargaining power to get the information that he wanted.
Oh, about Genesis? To use it as an ultimate weapon?
Right.
So they end up in this standoff, and Krug says, look, we've got hostages, and we're serious about executing them if you don't give up. And here, let me show you. And see, he orders one of the hostages to be executed. Dealer's choice. Whichever. It doesn't matter to Krug. So David, probably saving Savick and Spock, leaps on the Klingon guy and gets stabbed to death. They kill Kirk's son.
Bastards.
Yeah. And Kirk is not very happy about it.
You bastards have killed Kirk's son.
And he's
you bastards.
Legitimately... That's very good, actually. He's legitimately upset about it. I mean, actually, does a pretty good job in his overacting Kirk way.
I actually thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. He is like a gut punch. I mean, he really conveys that really well. So then we have a little Kirk switcheroo coming up, where they surrender, and they ask for a little time to prepare the crew, and Krug is very generous and gives them 2 minutes instead of just 1 minute. And Krug gets ready to put a boarding party, most of his crew apparently, aboard the Enterprise. And in the meantime, Kirk gets them to transport under the cover of the one transport. They transport themselves down to the surface and set the Enterprise to self-destruct. And so we get to see the Enterprise blow up.
I think that was another reason that maybe some people didn't like this movie, is because they destroyed, you know, the iconic Enterprise.
Well, and the theme is that Kirk has to give up everything that he loves for friendship.
But he sacrifices everything: his career, his ship, his son.
Yes. Yep, and the future of his. Like crew too. I mean, the commanders that are aboard that ship, they're going to be some splaining to do in the next movie.
Yeah.
But now, Kirk is on the planet and they meet up with the Klingons, and Kirk lures Krug to the planet and it tells Krug basically to beam his crew to the Klingon vessel. And Krug is like, fine, I'll have your crew up there. All except for you and Spock. And Kirk's like, no, send Spock too. He's like, no, nope, I'm not going to give you Spock. And why? Because you want it.
I know. I thought that, but that's probably pretty, pretty Klingon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, exactly. Yeah, I don't know why this guy is important, but because you find him important, I am not going to give him to you. By the way, Genesis has fallen apart like crazy. And Kirk and Krug end up having this very Star Trek hand-to-hand combat, where Kirk actually flips. Did you catch that? Like a backflip.
Yeah, I don't think it was him.
Of course it wasn't him. Absolutely not. No, it was some Gymkhana guy who was a stuntman. Because, good old Shatner had to do starvation diets to get into the suit every single movie. So he wasn't doing any backflips, that's for sure.
No. He didn't even run for T.J. Hooker. What are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
they just have him waddling and they move the set behind him. Yeah. I'm not kidding. You think I'm kidding.
I think you're kidding, but that's some funny stuff. So you mean...
Oh, my God.
You mean like Adrian Zemed had to run in place?
Yes.
Oh, that's funny.
Because Shatner can't really run.
Yeah, well, turns out neither can I.
If you ever notice any of those scenes, you never see his legs. It's all from the waist up.
Get out of town. You have to be making this up.
No, I'm serious. Go look at T.J. Hooker. I will find you info. I am not kidding.
Oh, that's T.J. Hooker rode the first Segway.
Yeah.
Oh, that's...
That was the Vulcan High Priestess.
I'm sorry, what?
Do you know who the Vulcan High Priestess?
Yeah. I was going to say Dame Judy Dench, but no.
Dame Judith Anderson.
Yes, yes. Another dame.
Yeah. Do you know what else she's from?
I'm guessing the Academy Awards at some point.
Sorry, we discussed it last week, but you won't remember. I remember because I was a fan. She was on Santa Barbara.
Get out of town.
No, she was Minx Lockridge.
Wait, hold on. Minx Lockridge? That was her character thing?
M-I-N-X. She was the dame of the Lockridge family.
Minx Lockridge. That is such a great soap opera name, too.
She was Lionel and Augusta's. She was Lionel's mother. you won't remember any of this.
No, I remember. I totally remember Lionel. Absolutely.
Yeah. She was Lionel's mother. And she was crazy and eccentric, and she was really, I mean, she was, by Santa Barbara, she was pretty old, but yeah.
That is so funny.
And I was, because she was really young in the Star Trek movie, or relatively younger-ish compared to Santa Barbara, but I was trying to place her, and then the name right into my head.
Minx Lockridge. That is a Santa Barbara soap opera name or a porn star. I love it. I love it so much.
How dare you, sir?
I just remember Lionel Lockridge was featured prominently, at least, in the movie Body Double, which is like it's kind of in that Skinamax kind of genre, except it's better. You know, I think Melanie Griffith was in it, and I thought it was pretty well done. But I remember thinking, oh, crap, that's Lionel Lockridge.
Yeah, and he's been in other stuff, and so it's hard to see him in other stuff.
Well, he has a very distinctive kind of five head.
Yeah, he has a very, he is unmistakable at anything he does.
Yeah, but not bad. Good stuff. Like, whatever happened to the girl who played, not Kelly Capwell, but who was the other Capwell?
Eden.
Yeah. What's her name?
Nancy Walker.
Yeah, whatever happened to her?
She had a career. She bounced around other soap operas.
Because, like, A. Martinez showed up in things here and there.
A. Martinez, my favorite A. Martinez role post-Santa Barbara was The Profiler.
The Profiler.
I loved The Profiler.
Who was in The Profiler? I'm thinking
another blonde who The Profiler.
That's not Ali Walker, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. I like Ellie Walker. She's great.
Yeah, and I think she was also in Santa Barbara.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. The Profiler, 96 TV series. You know, she was in like 4 or 5 seasons of The Profiler, and then they replaced her with another actress. They transitioned her off because, I guess she went out of the show or whatever. Come on, IMDb, you're too slow. Come on.
She's been in some really interesting kind of horror movies. In the 80s.
Ellie Walker?
Yeah.
I kind of like her, but also sometimes she really unnerved me because her mannerisms just drove me fucking nuts.
she reminds me of a little bit of like Dana Delaney. Like, she's good quality, but she hasn't been in like stuff that would really take your breath away, you know?
Yeah, I can see that.
Like, you can kind of rely on her, but you know she's not going to win an Academy Award, sadly.
Yeah, she was Andrea Bedford. She was in Santa Barbara as well, Ellie Walker.
Can you buy into Santa Barbara?
I don't think so. I would pay money if I could get it. If it had like a subscription on SoapNet or something, I would totally get it. It's not syndicated in the U.S., although inexplicably I was reading a couple months ago, it's huge in some foreign country that I thought, oh, that's different. I'll have to go back and find the article and revisit it later, but it's not available in the U.S., so.
Huh. Well, yeah, I mean, it's soap operas are unwieldy anyway, because you never know how much of them they have. And although I think you can buy the entire Dark Shadows, like 1,000 episodes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it comes in a coffin, which you can use once you've watched it, because it'll take you that long to watch it.
Sorry, Marcy Walker, not Nancy Walker. I don't know why I said. I don't remember which I said. I think I said Nancy Walker, which of course is not. It's Marcy Walker.
So Marcy Walker and Allie Walker were both on the same show?
Yeah.
Crazy. I assume they're not related.
No.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, so next on Santa Barbara Talk. anyway, Kelly Capwell, she was pretty.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, sorry. So back to the Genesis planet, where Kirk and Krug have a very Star Trek battle, and it ends in a very nice way, I thought, with Krug hanging off of a cliff over a bunch of lava, and Kirk reaches his hand down to save him, basically, even though they're better enemies, and Krug is having none of it, so he grabs Kirk's foot, and Kirk says, "I'm just about tired of you," and kicks him off the cliff into lava.
Yeah.
And that's nice and satisfying. And that's when Kirk screams his Klingon into the Klingon communicator to have him beamed up. And the only one left and the only one left aboard is John Larroquette.
I can't believe it was John Larroquette. I don't know.
You know who else was really pretty back in those days? Marky Post. Let me just say I'm a big Marky Post fan.
Underrated.
Yeah. No, I think she's about appropriately rated, but she was great. I remember she was in a made for TV movie maybe with Cindy Williams from Laverne and Shirley.
Wow.
Where she plays a prostitute and Cindy Williams is like a housewife and they have to team up. Anyway, sorry. For a stream of consciousness here.
All right.
Yeah. So he said he promised he was going to kill John Larroquette, but John Larroquette was bitter because he lied.
Well, and that's a big deal because in the Klingon, like you're never a prisoner as a Klingon. Like the only way to glory is to be killed in battle, and to be like captured as prisoner is like you have dishonored your entire family and bloodline.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Kirk is a jackass on purpose, which is good. It's fine, you know. I'll show you. Of course, what does he do with them? Because they can't go to Earth. They end up going to Vulcan, not only for the ceremony, the Fall Torpan, which is, I think you need a springform pan to do that properly, don't you? Like in some kind of like water bath.
Yeah, and it definitely helps.
So otherwise, you know, it'll crack and it's bad news. So, so Spock's Katra has to be reunited with his body.
They got to shove back in.
That's right. In this ceremony that could actually kill the Doctor, which it's sort of funny because I didn't quite get what at first when she asks, when Dame Minx Lockridge asks McCoy, whether, you know, what he chooses, because it's dangerous, and he says, I choose the danger. And then he kind of mumbles to Kirk, a hell of a time for her to ask. I didn't quite get what that meant, but I assume he meant, well, she could have asked me this, like, in the privacy of quarters where I could say no, but now that I'm in front of all these people and there's all these people waiting for the answer, you can't say no. It's like being on the kiss cam.
Yeah.
Yeah, so of course Spock is resurrected, and this the scene at the end is actually quite touching. Although, speaking of touching, as soon as Spock remembers that he called Kirk Jim, and he seems to recognize the crew, then everybody starts like slapping him on the back and like shaking his hand and kissing his baby. Dude, you didn't touch me before this. Don't touch me now. So it's kind of a happy ending, although you realize that, you know, the next movie, there's going to be a reckoning. You can't just steal a Starfleet. I mean, you're basically committing treason, right?
Well, and here's another point. Why did they need the Enterprise to go to Genesis? Why did they need a giant ship? Why didn't, with all the resources and friends and think, and, you know, I'm sure that Kirk had some pals that he could call in some favors. Like, why did they have to take the Enterprise? Why couldn't they have taken like a little runabout ship? Or, I mean, ostensibly there's other space travel. Like, they had to steal the Enterprise?
Well, I think they had to get there fast, so you needed the warp drive. And they already realized that, you know, McCoy kind of poisoned the Han Solo barrel. Because there's Federation security everywhere. And, you know, Federation, they're kind of jackasses. They said no and they meant no. And Kirk is a rogue who has, though his entire career was based on rational, what is the quote? Yeah, his career has been one of rationality and not intellectual chaos. His whole career has been noted by irrational exuberance.
And insubordination.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the Star Trek III, the search for Spock. Spoiler, of course, they found him.
Yeah.
But, you know. And then the next one is Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. So, presumably, they're going to go home. We'll see how that works out. So, overall, I like this movie a lot. I thought it had a lot to recommend it. Was it as good as the second one? No, maybe not. Is it going to be as good as the fourth one? Maybe not. So maybe of the three, it's a lesser. But the whole thing about the odd-numbered Star Treks being bad, it's just as stupid.
Well, this, of the odd-numbered ones, this is going to be the best one.
Well, yeah, because apparently 5, and I haven't seen 5 in a great while, but the word on the street is 5 is a bad one.
5 is bad.
I can't wait.
It is so bad. It's bad. I can't even. Yeah.
I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it, actually. I'm looking forward to the next one too. But yeah, I can't. 5 and 6 are going to be fun. I can't wait.
I liked 6. 6 was pretty good. I mean, I kind of dug 6. 4 was fun, I think, because of how it unfolded without, you know, going too much into 4. But I liked 4. And 4 was, again, 4 was one I saw in the theaters. 5 was not one I saw in the theater.
I don't remember whether I saw 5 or not in the theater. I know I saw 6 in the theater.
Yeah, me too. I think we saw
6 together. We probably saw it together. Yeah, exactly. So,
because I remember seeing it at the Fireweed 8.
I must have seen the theater. I can't imagine not seeing a Star Trek movie in the theater during those days.
I don't know. Star Trek 5, I don't know. I don't think so.
I think
we skipped 5.
I haven't really told the story of why I don't go to movies as much these days, but at some point we'll have to talk about that on the podcast.
We can have a whole podcast about how my movie habits of going to movies has changed as an adult.
Yeah, that might be interesting, actually. We'll have to investigate that. Oh, by the way, are we pretty much done with Star Trek 3?
I think those are all my notes for Star Trek 3.
Excellent. Well, until next week, remember, live long.
Live long and keep your contra to yourself.
Oh, you gotta get your handy going on with the Ponfar. Anyway, so you want to hear some stats?
Pawn far my Katra.
Yeah. hey, you got your pawn in my far. No, you got your far in my pawn. Taste delicious.
The whole finger thing. Why was that necessary? What dramatic element did that?
No, it was from the TV show. There's a whole episode where
it had no purpose. It added nothing to the story.
It added the Vulcan ritual thing, you know, because otherwise I'm sure fanboys would have freaked out if they didn't mention it. How could he be aging and not go through Ponfar?
Oh my God, you're probably right.
I'm pretty sure. They were careful about other things, so they might as well be careful about that. That seems unreasonable. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.